everybody, and welcome to the Jambase podcast. I'm Scott Bernstein, and Jambase is the media partner of Osiris Media, your place to hear music, podcasts, and more, including Eric Krasno Plus One, No Simple Road, Fear of a Craft Beer Planet, Comes a Time, and many others. A new season of Osiris's Past, Present, Future Live podcast premieres on October 20th. This episode of the Jambase podcast features an interview with Kevin Morby. Jambase's Andy Kahn recently spoke with Morby via a Zoom call about a variety of topics. Kevin's new album, Sundowner, will be released on October 16th. Morby discussed the genesis of the album, why it relies heavily on what he has to offer musically, the influence of a move to Kansas City, his dread of Nightfall, working with producer Brad Cook, his decision to record Sundowner at Sonic Ranch, and more about the follow-up to Oh My God with AK. Additionally, Kevin and AK chatted about Morby's live stream series, which ends on Friday, October 16th, with a complete performance of Sundowner, as well as recent shows that Kevin played at Red Rocks with Nathaniel Rateliff, in front of only 175 people each night. Morby also explained why he picked a show from Paris to release his live album, his nunchuck skills, and more. Before we get to AK's Kevin Morby interview, I want to fill you in on some of what's going on at Jambase. First, we just launched a newly redesigned Jambase iOS app that's been overhauled from the ground up to give you the full Jambase experience directly through the app. The new app features a streamlined design and loads of new updates, including the ability to read all of Jambase's articles right inside the app for the first time ever, and a powerful new search tool. We've also added supports for live streams, and we've made it even easier to find concert and music festivals wherever you are. Jambase is also excited about our 2020 Holiday Buying Guide. Each week, we'll help you find the perfect gift for the music lover in your life. We started with a guide to the top music books of 2020, including tomes about Pearl Jam, Bruce Springsteen, the Beastie Boys, Jimi Hendrix, Talking Heads, and many others. Stay tuned for new installments of the Jambase 2020 Holiday Buying Guide. As a reminder, head to jambase.com/videos for the Jambase Live Video Archive, where you can find and watch over 100,000 free streaming concert videos, filterable and sortable in many different ways. Plus, be sure to go stream live music via the Jambase Livestreams calendar at jambase.com/livestreams. Now, let's hear Andy Kahn's chat with Kevin Morby.
I am a sundowner, so live and leave. I am a sundowner, don't let the sun go down on me.
Well, Kevin, thank you for taking the time to talk with me. I actually was saying before I got to, I feel like I spent some time with you already last night. I watched your live stream of your, you did your whole album City Music as part of the series you're doing. That's really cool. How's that been going for you?
The live streams have been going really well. Obviously, if I could, I would prefer to be out on tour or, you know, playing for people in real life. And at first when they began, I really didn't like them, but as you know, as they've gone on, I've grown to enjoy them, and people seem to get something out of them, and I'm getting something out of them as well. So, you know, I'm enjoying it.
That's cool. And who was the guitar player that played with you last night?
His name's Cyrus Changris. He's played in my live band for a couple of years. He usually plays bass in my band, but he's also a very talented guitar player, and he was playing with me last night.
I thought it was really cool, some of the arrangements you guys did last night, especially City Music, which is one of my favorite songs of yours. But I thought that kind of stripped down arrangement you guys did last night was particularly cool.
Thanks, man. Yeah, it was fun. We never played it like that before.
Yeah, and I got to ask too, is the Patti Smith picture okay?
The Patti Smith picture is fine. Yeah, that was a funny moment, and it is almost as if I had planned that.
Right.
You know, it's kind of being held up by these two salt lamps, and I don't know. I guess I just like hit one at the last minute and it knocked it over. But yeah, all good. Everything's good. It was a funny way to go out.
It was literally like the last thing that happened. It was a framed picture of, I think, a magazine cover of Patti Smith. And right before you signed off, it crashed. It was like literally the last thing you saw before the screen went blank. So it was a pretty fitting and a pretty exciting way to close things out last night. And you've got two more left, right? You're going to do Oh My God next week. And after that will be the new album, Sundowner, right?
Yep, correct. Yep. Two more left and I'll be sad when they're over. They've been giving me something to look forward to.
Yeah, it's a cool way to be able to, for the fans to be able to connect with you too while all this shit's going on.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. It's cool. And it's been good for me too.
And then I also wanted to ask you about, so recently you played some gigs at Red Rocks, supporting Nathaniel Rateliff.
Yep.
So was the venue completely empty?
It wasn't completely empty. There's 175 people there, each night, which, you know, in a place that holds 9,000 people, it feels like it could be completely empty, but it kind of felt like playing like a living room show, you know, in an amphitheater, which is a very surreal, but, you know, ultimately a very fun experience.
And was the vibe particularly different in the venue? I mean, I know you said it felt like a living room, but were there other aspects of it that were particularly strange?
To be honest, backstage, it felt basically the same as it would anyways. Maybe there's less friends back there or something. And, mm-hmm. you know, everyone's in mask and they had to take your temperature before entering. But once you were actually in the backstage, it kind of felt like, you know, sitting backstage at any point before going out to play a show. But the, you know, the strangest part then was the reveal when you would, you know, you would walk out onto stage and there'd be, you know, barely anybody in this giant venue.
That's cool. And you did play some of the songs from Sundowner. How was that experience getting to play some of them live in front of people?
It was good. Yeah, it was really good. You know, I have been playing them for a little while now, but people have had no context for them. And mm-hmm. now that the record's been announced, it's been fun to sort of put them, you know, into a live set or play them online here and there. And people kind of know where they're coming from. It felt really good.
Awesome. I've been listening to Sundowner over the past few weeks. I really love the record. It's a very cohesive record, which is something that I think all of your albums are to some degree. But this one definitely has a definite like overall vibe to it that is peaceful, but yet there's an attentiveness to it, an attentiveness to your surroundings. I feel like it's an homage to the Midwest to some degree. How did moving back to Kansas City affect the content on the album?
You know, I, as an artist, I think that no matter what my environment is, I'm going to be influenced by it in one way or another, and it's going to make its way into my songs. And if history has proven anything with my previous albums, that's, yeah, certainly something that takes place. And so, you know, just moving here, I think I was very inspired by, you know, being back after living in Los Angeles for so long and New York before that, but having grown up in the Midwest, like returning here. You know, I hated it when I was a kid and I couldn't wait to get away from it. But coming back, I sort of saw it in this new light, you know, as a 30 something adult and having seen the world many times over, I have sort of a newfound appreciation for the Midwest and maybe things that I didn't really recognize it for, you know, certain aspects of beauty when I was living here as a kid, I was able to recognize now. And I was very moved by those things, just things as simple as, you know, the landscape or how big the sky is. And so yeah, you know, the sort of the solitude and the isolation that the Midwest can bring on too was, you know, kind of afforded me this time to work on music. And I was very inspired by that sort of space and time.
Don't underestimate Midwest American sun. Try as you might, but you will not outrun the burn. Say what you want and do what you will. Nothing will cover the fate that's been spilled. Don't underestimate Midwest American sun. Have fun with you.
Yeah, you mentioned isolation, and in the press materials, you said it's a depiction of isolation, which, I mean, given our current situation, is quite the coincidence, or I don't know if that's the right word, but you also mentioned that your current situation in quarantine is similar to what you were going through when you were writing the album. Was it just the being in the Midwest that was bringing about that sense of isolation, or were there other things happening?
That's a good question. And it's basically just being in the Midwest. My life has become so, before the lockdown, it had become so busy with touring. You know, I was doing more touring than I sort of ever imagined I would do. And I was kind of saying yes to every offer that came my way. And, I was just sort of running myself down and running myself wild with just flying all over the world, constantly playing whatever shows, you know, and I'm very fortunate to do those things. And I love doing those things. But there was something then about coming back to the Midwest and being suddenly so alone that I could really process all of those things. So I don't know, it was this weird juxtaposition in my life. I'd go live this big chaotic life, and then I would come home and it would be, I feel like I would maybe really crash from that other part of my life. And in doing that, and in this sort of crash that I would experience, I was working on these songs.
And was part of that crash, so is that where like sort of the concept of sundowner and, you know, the melancholy from a sunset, were you experiencing all that at the same time too then?
Yeah. You know, I think it's funny. A friend pointed this out to me recently and I hadn't really noticed it until he did, but on my earlier records, you know, most notably maybe on like my album City Music or it's maybe Singing Saw as well, I'm really singing a lot about embracing the night, like loving the nighttime. But I was sort of experiencing the opposite out here, where I would have these productive days, but once the nighttime came on, I was kind of very, you know, that's where the sort of loneliness or the isolation would really set in. So mm-hmm. I found myself sort of trying to, you know, I just not wanting the sun to go down. And that's sort of where the sundowner, you know, like something about the nighttime, like when you don't have a social life or something to do, you don't have a show to play or a bar to go meet friends at or something, suddenly you're just sort of faced with yourself. And that was definitely after 12 years of living and socializing in these huge cities. It was this new thing that I was facing. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, that's the opposite of being on tour, right? Like everything happens after sun goes down most of the time.
I'm used to that lifestyle. And then suddenly I'm back in my hometown and yeah, you know, I was on, I guess, more of a regular schedule than I'd been on in terms of waking up and going to sleep. And, I just found myself sort of dreading the nightfall.
And so what was the timeline between writing and recording Oh My God and Sundowner? Cause it seems like there's some overlap there, right?
Yeah, there's definitely some overlap. And like, Oh My God, I wrote some of it when I was still living in LA, but a lot of it I wrote, you know, I wrote it on planes and in hotel rooms and backstages and during sound checks. So mm-hmm. a lot of it was written sort of in that other part of my life, you know, that was very transient and very, you know, mm-hmm. just this other part of me basically wrote that. And, you know, and then I would come back here and Sundowner was this very closed door, you know, just me with no one around. And that's sort of what took place in those circumstances.
And so you also talked about how you used a four track Tascam Model 424, in writing the songs on Sundowner. That seems like it was a different approach for you. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I bought that just to kind of, you know, I had one in high school and I never really got too good at it. And I just figured since I was going to be here with some time on my hands, I might as well buy something that I could kind of mess around with and, you know, kind of almost just take on as a hobby or something. And, at that time I was finishing up writing Oh My God. And so I kind of had this idea of like, oh, maybe I'll get a four track and I can like do like a four track version of it just to learn the machine. And before I could even really start on that project, I just ended up writing this whole new collection of songs, which then became Sundowner. So it's, you know, I wrote the whole record with headphones on, sort of listening back to myself in real time. And so it was kind of like I was in this closed in environment, in two different ways. You know, one way, like I was in my house in Kansas City, sort of isolated. And then in another way, it was very internal. I was singing to a machine and it was playing it right back at me, and I was closed off by my headphones. And so, it really became this like writing companion in a way.
So it became, it was more insular of a process for you than it typically is.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, when you think about like I was saying, like, oh my God, I wrote a lot of those songs or lyrics or whatever, like on airplanes, you know, surrounded by tons of people. And, this is something that I wrote just in the complete opposite environment. And yeah, it was a very insular record, to the point where, you know, I didn't even really recognize what it was at first. Some of it felt very personal, and like, it was just therapeutic for me to be doing, and maybe I wouldn't release it, or, you know, maybe I would release it under a different name, but ultimately I decided it's best to release it and just do it under my name.
That's interesting, because I feel like it's some of your most personal, material in some ways. To hear you say that you'd maybe put it under a different name it's a bit surprising to me. I really feel like some of the lyrical content in particular is pretty striking and seems to be striking a personal chord for you.
Yeah. And I think maybe that's what gave me the inclination to maybe naturally drift away from it, was just some insecurity of not wanting to put myself out there as much as I felt I was. You know, so sort of as a defense mechanism or something, and there's a moment in time where I thought maybe this will be my first album that's self-titled, because this one in a way feels like my actual first solo record. All the other albums, it's very dependent on a producer or a band, and kind of like evolving in the studio, where this one, it really felt like a sort of stripped away solo album.
Right. Yeah. That's actually something I wanted to talk to you about, because, there are so few other musicians on the record. Brad Cook, who produced it, is on there. Was that a conscious effort for you to say you didn't want to have a lot of other participants? You wanted it to be you mostly?
Yeah, I wanted it to be me. You know, it's funny, because I used to play bass in a band called Woods, and despite that fact, I'm not a good bass player. In that band, I just played parts that they wrote for me, but for the most part. And, you know, so for this, like, I'm just, point being, I'm not a great bass player, and I knew that I would have to have someone play bass. I knew Brad could play bass, and I wanted Brad to produce the record. But other than that, I knew that I wanted to do most everything. I wanted it to be, you know, an album in which everything was sort of touched by me. Whereas, you know, a lot of my other processes are hiring a band or getting the best guitar player I can think of, or the best key player, or, you know, this person or that person. And for this one, I wanted it just to be, rely heavily on like what I had to offer musically and otherwise.
And you mentioned, we've mentioned Brad Cook produced it. I just actually interviewed his brother, Phil, not too long ago for a couple of episodes back.
Oh, great.
What's your relationship with Brad? He seems to just be an amazing musical mind.
Yeah, Brad's amazing. You know, we're very good friends at this point. I've known Brad for, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years, and he's a very unique person. He's a very unique soul, and Brad, you know, he has many strengths, but one of his greatest strengths is, I think, helping others. He's motivational. He can really help someone believe in what they're doing. I feel like if Brad believes in it, he's going to get you on board. And there was many parts of this process of making this album with him where I was sort of doubting it along the way, you know, saying like, oh, I play drums on the demos, but we'll get a real drummer to come in the studio and play the drums. And, you know, he was able to convince me like, no, you can do it. You know, you're just as good of a drummer as anyone else, and I think you should do it. And, you know, there's a lot of moments like that. And, you know, Brad is, yeah, he's almost like a spirit guide or something. He's a very, very wonderful human.
And how did you decide then to go to Sonic Ranch to record? That again also seems like a very popular and musically magical place these days.
Yeah, you know, I first heard of Sonic Ranch when I heard that Beach House had recorded there.
Okay.
And I remember them talking about it probably 10 years ago or something. And then I thought like, oh, El Paso. And I'd always had a really good but strange time playing in El Paso. And it's just a town that stuck out to me for, you know, a bunch of different reasons. And so I was like, oh, wow, there's some recording studio on the border of Mexico and El Paso. That sounds strange. And Beach House recorded there and it sounds great. And then I heard a Bright Eyes record that was recorded there. And then that was all like, you know, about a decade ago. But then Big Thief recorded their album Two Hands there. And I actually hadn't heard of it. I hadn't heard the album yet, but I had, it kind of put the name back into my brain. And so when talking to Brad about where to record it, he had recommended some studios, you know, in New York, and those are great studios. But I wanted to make sure, since the subject matter was so heavily influenced by the Middle America, that we stayed away from a coast. And so just naturally, Sonic Ranch seemed like, an ideal place to do it. And it's a very, very magical place. And it was a huge part of this process.
So how long were you guys there for the main sessions?
We were only there for I guess 7 days, and like recording for five of them. It was very quick. The whole process was incredibly quick. And we meant to go back before the lockdown to do the mixing altogether, but the lockdown took place. So it ended up just getting mixed by our friend Jerry, who is an in-house engineer there. And he was able to, so he mixed it back in the studio that we recorded it in, but Brad and I were just from our homes. But yeah, it was a very short session, and it just kind of effortlessly came together.
What's the layout there like? Is it the type of place that you stay at the whole time you're recording? Or like, do you live there while you're recording?
Yeah, there's a bunch of little like casitas that you stay in, and they're beautiful. And there's like a pool, and even though when I was there, the winter is a little too cold to swim, but mm-hmm. it's on a pecan field of 3,000 acres of pecan farm. And It's very beautiful. You just eat the pecans, and you stay there, and it's kind of like this amazing, there's three studios. So there's two other studios that are, you know, there's going to be other bands there, and you all kind of eat lunch together. And, you know, I met a person from my hometown who I'd always heard about, but never actually met. And he happened to be there with his band. And, it's kind of like a really cool sort of desert music camp or something.
And was the pump organ that's prominent on the record, was that there at the studio, or did you bring that with you?
I brought that with me. That's something that I found here in Kansas City at an antique mall. And it's like a World War II era pump organ that folds in and out of itself. It's really cool. And it's a, you know, slightly out of tune, but it's got a lot of magic to it.
Were you familiar with that instrument before the record?
Yeah, I had played a pump organ. Not this sort of model, not this sort of mm-hmm. transportable one, but I had played one on my record City Music on one song. And that was a situation where it was just in the studio. And I was so moved by it. I thought it was so cool that you could do something like that, play a pump organ where, you know, you're sort of bringing the sound out of it in two different ways. And so when I found it in the antique store, I was so excited, and, I bought it immediately.
And it made it back safe and sound to Kansas City?
Yeah, it's here. I'm looking at it right now, actually.
So I'm also interested in the album has a couple of singles, Campfire and Wander, that have music videos. When were those shot?
We shot those over the summer, I think in July, and we just shot a new one that'll come out after the album, which I'm really excited about. But yeah, we shot those here, and it was kind of a perfect situation because, you know, we shot them outside, and, you know, we were able to socially distance and Katie, my girlfriend, you know, I knew that I just wanted it to be the two of us. I wanted it. There's going to be three videos. Ultimately, there's already two, but I wanted them all to feel like scenes from a movie.
Right. They do. They seem like there is a continuity between them so far, at least, particularly that Ford truck that's in both of them. Is there a story behind that truck?
No, you know, we just wanted an old Ford, and we rented it from a woman, I believe her name is Morgan, who's here in town, and the cinematographer knew her. And she has this wonderful truck that she was able to rent to us.
It's a beautiful vehicle. And I know Katie's record, St. Cloud, has a Ford on the front of it too. So I didn't know if there was something particular about Ford trucks, old Ford trucks or not.
I mean, you know, Katie and I are dating, so I think there's a lot of psychic overlap happening with us at all any given time in terms of our music and visuals. And I like to think that her record and my record, you know, a lot of my songs are about her and a lot of her songs are about me on you know, our respective albums. And I like to think of it as just this universe that we're both kind of building around one another. It's really nice.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I was telling my wife I was only going to be able to tell you that Sundowner was one of the best records this year because St. Cloud is so great itself. I really love Katie Waxahachie, we should say, but she's terrific and it really great in the videos too. I think it's fun to watch her in kind of a different setting.
Yeah.
Campfire also has a few references. It references some people that have passed away: Richard Swift, Anthony Bourdain, Jesse Zazu. What was your decision to want to honor those people and put it in lyrics so kind of, you know, bluntly, so to speak?
It's something that I've done kind of a lot in my music, you know, and I think, you know, I've been inspired throughout my life about, you know, or from people, maybe I feel like a lot of people have done stuff like that. You know, Bob Dylan has honored Woody Guthrie, Patti Smith has honored, you know, a long list of poets and artists before her. And, I think there's something about paying it forward. Well, like number one, I think it just happens naturally. You know, I don't necessarily, most any song I write, I don't set out to think, oh, I'm going to write a song about a dead friend or a dead hero. Mm-hmm. It just sort of comes out, you know, in a very therapeutic, I'm working on a song and, you know, their name falls out of my mouth as I'm coming up with lyrics. Mm-hmm. But I also think that, you know, what makes me want to like really run with that is that I think as an artist to honor the dead and to honor the people that came before you or that, you know, were your peers or whatever that you were inspired by, it's important. And I think that, you know, I like to think that maybe there's someone out there who doesn't know who Jesse Zazu is, but now will after hearing my song, or, you know, doesn't understand exactly who Richard Swift was, but now we'll look a little further into it and can enjoy his music. Or someone who, you know, maybe thinks like, oh, I never watched Anthony Bourdain. Like, that's interesting. I wonder, like, I guess let me give it a crack. And then, you know, it's a way of keeping those people alive through, you know, through art.
Yeah. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful, tribute to those people.
Hey, who are you? Did you hear the news? Anthony's dead and poor Richard too. They billow, and it makes me nervous. They whittle a fiddle from wood in our service. Now that it's dusk, kids scatter the avenues. Hey, who are you? I'm a Sundowner too.
Another beautiful tribute on the record is Jamie. Tell me about how that song came about and how long it took you to sort of develop it to where to its final form.
So that's, you know, Jamie was one of my best friends when I was 20 who unfortunately passed away, and it was a big turning point in my life. It made me think about life and death completely differently, you know, because up until that point, no one too close to me had really passed away. And, you know, you sort of think you're immortal at that point in your life. And then something like that happens to you. And it sort of breaks the foundation of everything, you know? And so Jamie has been a huge muse. You know, he's a kind of an older brother to me, and I always really looked up to him, and he's been a huge muse to me, my whole career. And in a lot of ways, I feel like I owe a lot to him. And, you know, so I have multiple songs about him. This is the only one that really directly addresses him by name.
Right.
And, you know, that's a good example of a song. I kind of thought it would never be released. You know, I sort of, you know, was just, it felt therapeutic as I was writing it into my four track, and almost at the time felt like I never had any intention of anyone else hearing it. I also mentioned my friend Desiree who passed away a couple of years ago, about 5 years ago, who, you know, I didn't know nearly as well as Jamie. I was in a relationship at the time, and my partner was best friends with this woman, Desiree, who, you know, I was friends with, but just kind of by way of my ex-partner. And Desiree was just a beautiful soul who passed away in a surfing accident. And in both these cases of Jamie and Desiree, they're two people who were really influential to people around them and have kind of taken on this mythological existence since their deaths, just because they were such forces while they were here living. And in both their cases, I missed both their funerals because, of course, I was out on tour, which is,
brutal.
Yeah. Seems insane. But so I kind of saw their funerals from afar, from photos and things I heard. And they both seemed like these kind of these big, almost like these parades in my mind. And so it's just a song about, the two of them and mainly Jamie and just longing for a dead friend, basically.
Yeah, it's beautiful, and I get the mermaid reference, and my condolences, man, for your losses. But I think you're honoring them in a very beautiful way.
Thank you.
Jamie was a friend of mine. He was 25 when he died. He was 25 when he died. You need hate me, but I get angry. Well, I wish my friend was still alive. Oh, Lord. Oh, I wish my friend was still
alive. Another instance where you got to honor sort of by at least tangentially Richard Swift was on the new Fleet Foxes record on the track Sunblind,
yes.
Right? How did that go about? Like, I know that Robin's been recording that on and off for the past couple of years. Did you do your part before or after the quarantine?
I did it just very recently. He turned that record around incredibly quickly. I think he finished the album only a week before he released it, which is really cool. So I think I did my vocal part maybe 2 or 3 weeks before the record even came out, and he just sent me the song, and he really didn't even give me too much direction. He just said, there's some empty space at the end. Feel free to come up with something. And so I just kind of sang this little part of, the main hook, the lyrical hook, the warm American water. And I love that song. And that's a great example of something. And I think Robin's sort of in a similar headspace of honoring, just those who came before us, And I think something about quarantine seemed to, in the lockdown, inspire Robin rather than depress him, in the fact that, like, I'm just grateful to be alive. And, there's so many people for, whatever various reasons, who aren't here with us. And, perhaps had it not been for Elliott Smith or Richard Swift or David Berman, maybe I wouldn't be inspired to make music at all. So, just paying homage to those people.
Yeah. I saw you and Katie pay homage to Berman last year in California at the Yola Tango campout at Big Sur.
Oh, no, you were there.
Yeah, definitely. That was beautiful, man. That was
awesome. Yeah, thanks, man. That was really fun.
That whole weekend was just amazing. And a lot of my coworkers, almost all of Jambase, was there that weekend, and we've all independently talked to one another about how excited we are that we went and it got to experience it. Especially now that we've been so deprived of going to live music and events like it, that it's helped at least to have those memories from that great experience.
Yeah, totally, man. That was a good time. And it was a somber time too, because David Berman had meant to be there. And
no doubt.
But yeah, it's, I think that was almost just a year ago, almost to the day. And that was a beautiful time.
Yep, definitely. So the other thing I wanted to ask you about, I picked up your Record Store Day release recently, Omandu. It's a live album from a show you played in Paris. It's a great recording. What was it about that show that made you want to press it and release it?
Well, number one, I wanted to document my live band, the Oh My God Band, which I was very proud of. It was kind of a bigger band with backup singers and, a horn player and Sam Cohen on guitar. And it was just this sort of, a really amazing band. And I wanted to document it first and foremost. And I chose Paris because Paris is, it's always been a very good city for me. I've always done very well in France. I'm not exactly sure why, but I'm very thankful that I do. And, from my first tour in Europe, you know, I was playing everywhere. I played the whole continent basically. And, you know, there was maybe like 40 to 60 people coming to all my shows. And then I showed up in Paris and there's 200 people there. And
oh, wow.
It's just always been sort of one of my bigger shows. And, we were playing this place, Cabaret Sauvage, which is a very beautiful venue. And I'd always wanted to play there, and we had sold it out ahead of time. And I just knew it was going to be a sort of magical summer night. And so, you know, I wanted to, it's sort of a thank you to the people of Paris for always showing up so hard for me at my shows. You know, deciding to do a live record there rather than somewhere else is just sort of a saying, you know, thank you for being such great fans.
That's cool. Yeah. You mentioned that band. It is a pretty incredible band. Do you think that, is that band done now, or will that group ever get back together, do you think?
Yeah, I think it'll get back together. I mean, you know, a lot of that depends on the state of the world, but
sure.
You know, with Sundowner, I wanted to go the complete opposite and have like a ramshackle thing. And I would love to sort of tour around it in a sort of, you know, off the beaten path sort of formation. You know, I would love to play record stores with maybe like a 3-piece band or something. But my next record that I'm working on, I would love to bring back something like the Oh My God band and kind of have that be my band from then on out.
Yeah, I hope I get to see it. I didn't get to catch that tour, but it translates really well to that record, and it definitely is an impressive group of players that you assembled for sure.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that.
All right. Well, I can let you go, but before I do, I just want to ask, how's your nunchuck skills these days?
They're good, man. I'm getting, you know, I was struggling with my left hand. It's something I did as a kid, and then I put down, and then quarantine just brought it back out of me, the desire to nunchuck. It's actually very meditative. I like, you know, it's just, I kind of just pick them up like when I have nothing else to do, and it's like a nice way to basically not look at my phone and do something else with my hands. Yeah, it's good. I'm trying to get better with the left hand, and I'm improving.
Well, no bullshit, man. It's impressive, and it's unexpected, but I could see where it keeps you busy.
Thank you. I'm glad you appreciate it.
Well, just don't hurt yourself, okay?
I'll try. I'll try my best. Thanks.
Everybody, make sure to get Sundowner. It's coming out October 16th on Dead Oceans. Kevin, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. Stay safe out there. Tell Katie hello. Tell her album's great. Be well, man.
Thanks, man. Thanks. It's nice to meet you, Annie.
You too, bud. Take care.
Bye-bye.
I wonder, as I wonder, why was I born in the wild wonder? It was a dream, only a dream, and it came back to you and me. And I wonder, as I go now, did I ever even know now? And I wonder, as I wonder, why was I born in the wild wonder?
That's a wrap for this episode of the Jambase Podcast. Thanks to Kevin Morby for taking the time to talk to us. His new album, Sundowner, drops on Friday, October 16th via Dead Oceans. Also, be sure to visit headcount.org for information on how to register to vote. Headcount also has information regarding dates for important deadlines, what's on your ballot, and everything you need to know to vote in your state, whether in person or by mail. The Jambase Podcast is produced by Jake Alexander and features music from Clangin' and Bangin'. Stay safe, my friends, and go see live music when you can.